Welcome back to the OIS Retina Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. This is Faraz Rahal, the host. Of course, I'm part of Los Angeles Retina Group, known as Retina Vitreous Associates Medical Group. That's where I'm broadcasting from today. And I'm also a partner at Excite Ventures, which is out of New York City. And I've been with that for a number of years, too. Today, I'm delighted to have another great guest. This is one of my friends. Everyone knows who this is now, Cedric Francois. The head of Apellis, co-founder and CEO of Apellis Pharmaceuticals, and an all-around great guy. Cedric, thank you for joining us and taking the time to share some of the information.
Thank you, Shiraz. Really a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. So, you know, typically, and I'm going to do this with you too, I like to ask people a little bit about their own personal background, because I find, and I think the viewers find that to be some of the most interesting parts. A lot of people know the data and what's been published, but what they don't know is the kind of the personal story or the journey. And I think that's really some of the most interesting things, particularly with you. Please take a few minutes and tell us about your, you know, educational, professional background, where you were in the beginning of your medical training and so forth.
Yeah, thank you, Shiraz. Well, without making it too long for you guys. So I'm from Belgium originally. I went to medical school at the University of Leuven, and I came to Louisville, Kentucky in 1999 to join a team that at the time was doing the first hand transplantation, which was a new procedure. And the reason why it had taken so long to do that was because the immunosuppressive regimens that were necessary to transplant skin were discovered in that laboratory. So this was my first foray into the United States. I did my PhD there. And around 2002, 2003, my best friend was attending HBS at the time, Alec McEels, and they wanted to participate in a business plan competition. And you know, I was on calls, I was joining that a little bit. And one time Alec visited me, and I had an idea that I could only have because I knew nothing about what they were doing. It was semi-creative. So all of a sudden I was a member of that team. it won the HBS business plan competition and got a little bit of notoriety from that. But the interesting thing was that it was an idea like you have in a business plan that like doesn't really mean anything. We tried to raise money unsuccessfully. And for 2 years, we were on phone calls until one day I was like, look, we're not going to do this forever. Why don't we get together in a place, the three co-founders, and see what we can do together? And so that ended up being Louisville, Kentucky, because I went to the university there and I said, hey, you know what? There's these two Harvard grads, you know, that could come and join your faculty here. So we got term track faculty positions at the University of Louisville with the promise that we could do whatever we wanted entrepreneurially, which was a really extraordinary position to be in. And we then had to decide how to raise money.
Always difficult.
I had never done that, right? I mean, it was a new foray for me as well. And my favorite story from the early days was that Pascal and Paul, my co-founders, were going to join us at the time for this company called Potentia in Louisville if I could raise $300,000. That was the cutoff. And I did a few pitches, and I didn't know the difference at the time between soft commitments and money in the bank. Yeah. So I had a couple of guys that were like, and girls that were like, interesting. And I'm like, I've got it. Pack your bags, leave Boston and come to Louisville. So they came, and then I called the money, and the money was, of course, not there. Yeah. So this was a very stressful period for me, man. I was like, wow.
Yeah.
So then I was going around in New York pitching this, and it was really not going well. I sucked at doing this until one day I step into an office with one of the original employees of Morgan Stanley. And they had an office in New York that they called Jurassic Park because they considered themselves the dinosaurs. And I walked in with this gentleman, and I felt naked. Like, this guy saw straight through me. And for about an hour, I pitched. At the end, he's like, not interested. And I went back to the hotel, and I felt like I had missed an opportunity. And in the morning I woke up, I told my friends, I said, I have to see him again. And they're like, that doesn't work that way. Bought a bottle of wine, gave it to his assistant, and I waited in the corridor until he like walked by. And I said, can I see you again? And he's like, sure. And then we sat down and I said, look, everything you told me yesterday is true. We don't have anything, but the two people I work with are the best people I've ever met. And we're going to do all we can to make this happen. And he went on his intercom. He's like, Sheila, write me a check for $100,000, please.
No way. That's incredible. It's amazing what a great bottle of wine can do, by the way. The wine was the key to the whole thing. Never mind your charming personality.
I was like, so this is how it's done, right?
Yeah, wine. Yourself
and have a good bottle.
Solution to all problems is an excellent bottle of wine. That's wonderful. So he went for it right away.
He went for it, and he actually asked me, what's your name, young man? Yeah. And he wrote it in my name, and afterwards and I said, I don't have any documents. He says, it's fine, you can send it afterwards. So it was amazing. It was like such a, and then he said, I think this is really interesting. He said, like, look, you don't think you will, but you will be back here next year asking for more money. And I don't want to not have heard anything from you and yada, yada. Therefore, every month, I want you to send me a one pager with your budget variance, what you spent, key events, and your pitfalls and solutions. That's all I asked. And for 11 or 12 years, every month, I did that. So I literally have like a huge binder with the whole story month by month and all the stuff that we did at the time. But it was an amazing way of engaging with what we call these angel investors, right? Because I brought this group of people together that believed in us, that were with us, that knew all the time what we were doing. We always made a point of under-promising and over-delivering. And by the time we sold Potencia to Alcon in 2009, we had raised $23 million, 17 from angel investors and 6 in the last round from a VC, which, you know, people that start companies will tell you is very unusual, right? Usually you have a little bit of money from angels and then you try to get VCs. But anyway, that was the founding story behind how we became entrepreneurs, I guess. And then people always ask me, like, how did you end up doing retina work, right? How did you end up doing complement in the retina? And there too, talking about serendipity. I had heard at the time what iTech was doing with Macugen and had got an interest in what is the mechanism behind this disease. We realized that anti-VEGF drugs dry the eye, but don't really treat the underlying condition. And we were trying to find ways to modify macrophage behavior. And we had a couple of things that we came up with, all of which kind of were interesting. But since we knew nothing at the time, we did the cost of what it would cost us to make that drug per patient per year. It was a couple of million dollars. So we were idiots because we had never thought through that. Yeah. And as we were like thinking, okay, what are we going to do next now? Pascal and I walked through a corridor and we see a poster on complement. And we were like, you know what? Complement's a great way to change macrophage behavior. And then we went to the office and we Googled complement inhibitors. And that's how it started.
So initially you were, I didn't know this, that Macugen, you know, was one of the inspirations there. That's an interesting point. So you saw that this new treatment had come about for what we now, you know, refer to as wet AMD. And you were thinking we can maybe do better by going after the underlying disease. And you thought of complement at the point. Was there a literature on complement in AMD at that time? What was the history around that time, or what made you make the connection?
Our belief that macrophages were at the root of the disease and that by controlling complement, we could change macrophage behavior in the retina. So that was really the genesis behind it.
It's always a really long road between, innovative thinking and then commercialization. It's ridiculously long. I won't ask you to recite that, but this has been a particularly long road, but I don't think unusually so. A lot of stories like this, that lots of trials and tribulations, pitfalls, joyful moments. What can you tell us about the road from that point where you started this idea, this project with the complement and the macrophages for AMD? Now, you know, you've gotten to the finish line, at least from a regulatory standpoint. where were the high points, but more importantly, where were the low points? Where were the threatened areas where you, again, may have thought, yeah, this isn't going to make it? What do you remember about those?
Every minute.
Yeah, too many to count. So what about the too numerous to count, as we say in medicine, as you know? What were the big ones? Fundraising, science, where did the biggest challenges come from? And if all of the above, pick a few.
Yeah, I'll take a few. Well, first of all, in the history of Potencia, kind of the most seminal moment for us was in 2005 at the Macula Society in Key Biscayne in February. And again, going back to at the time, Macuzen was all the rage, and you know, everybody was talking about iTech, etc. And we had found an angel investor, somebody called Bernard Darty. Let me share his name. He has passed away in the meantime, but he was incredibly important to us. His wife had macular degeneration as well. And he wanted to make $1 million investment in our company. So this was the moment where we could finally go a little bit further with more capital on board, etc. And he said, why don't you come and see me at the Macula Society meeting in Key Biscayne? And I'm like, I don't think I can go there. But I figured out a way. We paid $5,000. I could only attend. And I remember this was my entry into the retina, right? I mean, I remember in Key Biscayne walking into the Oval Lawn on Sunday and meeting all these retina doctors. And I was 33 at the time. Nobody wanted to talk with me, especially when they heard I was industry. They thought I was a sales rep, probably. Anyway. But that's where I met my first friends and who became dear friends afterwards. And a couple of things happened. During that meeting, Bernard Darty was going to meet with me and he said, I'm going to bring a specialist with me to evaluate your idea. And I'm like, oh, okay. I said, fine. And I said, who is it? I can't tell you, whatever. But then I thought, look, he's going to the Macula Society. He's going to bring somebody to see me. And since he's French, that person is going to be French. I looked at the roster of the Macula Society. And at the time, I found three French men and women that were on the Macula Society. It was Eric Souid, Gisèle Soubran, and Gabriel Koskas. I read every paper that these three individuals had published in their entire life and learned it by heart.
This is good detective work. You, the fine sleuth, that was really high quality police work there, Cedric. I'm impressed.
And then I found everything out about Bernard Darty and his wife, etc. Because it's important, right? So I'm armed with my knowledge. I walk into this meeting and Bernard is there and he says, ah, bonjour, Monsieur François. He's a very imposing guy, man. He was incredibly charismatic. So I was feeling very tiny. I sat down and he said, in walks, knock on the door, in walks Gabriel Koskas. So I kind of had my moment there. I sat down, he sits in front of me. We start talking and of course his legacy is Indocyanine and green imaging, right? Yeah. So, I dropped ICG into my picture at some point and he asked a question about it. So I was like, yes. He said, well, like in your publication in Ophthalmology in 1999 on page 1200, and his jaw dropped to the floor. It was epic. So that was the first event that weekend. The second one was at a gala dinner. I was sitting next to Michael Klein from Oregon. And between him and his wife. And him and his wife and I start talking and sharing stories. And at some point, she's like, hey, Michael, you should talk to this young man here. So we start talking. And here's what we were doing. And literally, he goes pale. And he's like, how do you know all of this? And I'm like, what do you mean? And he's like, well, I cannot tell you anything. But in 2 to 3 months, you will see and you will know that you have to call me. And I will join your scientific advisory board. And I'm like, okay, weird, but whatever. Yeah. And what had happened is I think it was in April or May of 2005, these seminal publications establishing a relationship between the complement factor H-SNP and macular degeneration came out in Science, three publications at the same time. This was the first breakthrough out of the Human Genome Sciences project. And Michael Klein had been a reviewer on one of these papers.
I see. Okay. So he couldn't tell you then, but he'd already read the papers. I got it.
That's right. Amazing.
This is serendipity for sure, or not really. I mean, you were onto something independently while other people were apparently onto it too.
Yes, so it was a beautiful moment. But all of a sudden, we were in the front seat, right? I mean, now we had something that everyone was interested in that we could work with. So, next seminal moment, of course, was 2009, when we had done our phase one clinical trial, everything had been going well, and then in 2008, the financial crisis hits. Yeah. Right. So in 2009, we had to raise money and there was no money to be found anywhere. This was a huge, huge problem. We had capital until October and we were going to go bankrupt. But at the time, we were lucky. Three companies were interested in acquiring us. That process kind of unfolded over the summer. And, talking about tough moments, this was the first one that was really, and for me personally, at least, the toughest moment, because I remember in August of 2009, my mom came to Louisville and I lived in an apartment there. I would wake up every morning at 3 o'clock covered in sweat, because I knew that if I was going to fail at selling the company at that point in time, I was no longer a physician. I hadn't seen patients in 6 years. My PhD was worthless, and this was my final exam as a CEO. I failed it. It was over.
Yeah, I got it. That's pressure.
There was no recourse for me if that was going to fail. And there were three companies, but there ended up being one company, Alcon. And Alcon at the time had been bought by Novartis. I don't know if you recall that. And
I recall it very well.
Hadn't closed yet, but Dan Vassella was on the board at Alcon. And at some point, Kevin Buehler, the CEO of Alcon, calls me and says, like, hey, Cedric, I have to ask you this, but it's Novartis, one of the other bidders. And I said, yeah. So I told him the truth, right? And it was a very uncomfortable moment because there was the Chinese wall, but there wasn't. Anyway, we ended up with Alcon pursuing the opportunity. And even the morning of the signing, Kevin called me and he asked me, he said, I just want to make sure that we didn't offer more than Novartis did. And I said, no, it was more or less the same, which was true. And then we signed it. And it was very funny because we signed this agreement. This was like, finally we had established something. And I thought I was going to feel immense joy, but I really felt nothing. I didn't even feel
relieved. Why do you think that is?
I think it was like, it was
anticlimactic or just...
Anticlimactic, yes. Yeah. Anticlimactic and just also... I was in love with this company, with what we were doing.
Exactly. So it's like buyer's remorse. It's like a seller's remorse. You're all of a sudden your baby now belongs a little bit to somebody else.
Yeah, exactly. So
that's amazing. That was
seminal moment number two. Seminal moment number three was we then founded at Apedis in the beginning, again from the investors that were in Potencia, of course. And then I had the opportunity to meet our chairman, Gerald Chan, who's one of the most amazing human beings you've ever met. He became a small shareholder in the company at the time. but in 2013, 14, we were going to raise our first important capital. As it turns out, what we had done between 2010 and 2013 was to create a molecule that could control complement factor C3 systemically in the whole body. And that was, at the time, considered very difficult because there's so much C3 in the body. People were worried that it wouldn't be safe, that it would, that it wouldn't work because there's too much C3. But we had established good data that we could indeed accomplish this. And then Novartis had not met the diligence requirements for our ophthalmology program at Potencia. And that gave us the opportunity in 2014 with Apedis to buy Potencia and bring that back into the house. And
so we bought back the Potencia science and the product.
That's correct. And the IP, yes. But what we did is we said, we're going to take that molecule that we developed for subcutaneous administration, and we're going to concentrate that molecule and inject it in the eye. And I remember at the time, I had a conversation with Len Schleifer about this, because people forget that Eylea is Zaltrap as well, right? So it's a systemic drug as well. And he said, look, if it's the right molecule, you should just do it. So We then, between the summer of 2014, when we got the rights back, and September of 2015, we did all of the IND enabling work. We did a phase one study, and we started the Philly phase two clinical trial in approximately 16 months or so. It was
really fast.
Mind-blowingly fast and well executed. Yeah. So that was another really important moment for us, because now we had these two programs. On one end, a systemic program where in paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, you have a very easy disease where in three patients, you know whether your drug works, right? But where the challenge is the whole body versus the eye, where, you know, you inject a tiny, tiny amount of drug, but showing efficacy in geographic atrophy, we all know how hard that is, right? So these two programs, in a way, balanced each other out quite well. And then the next step for us was in 2017. So a couple of years later, in the beginning of the year, we had a company that was interested in acquiring us in what was a really good deal at the time. We had only spent maybe $30 million or so. The upfront was $300, you know, $2.5 billion in milestones. I mean, at the time, that was a really, really good deal for us. But then in around March or April of that year, knowing, this is 2017, knowing that the Philly trial was going to read out in August, right? We had those cases of exudations. First time that we saw this. And our counterparty freaked out and they stepped out of it. They're like, you know, we're not going to step in front of the readout, not knowing what this is, etc. Okay, fine. So now we had money. It's now, by the time it's all done, it's April, May-ish, more or less this time of the year. Again, we had money only until August of that year, like literally at the time of the readout. So now we went around and we tried to raise money. And again, with a lot of stress behind us. and this was interesting because we got a syndicate together for about $16 million at the time of a pre-money valuation of $225. So it was a good deal. Everything was where it needed to be. But it was entirely premised on the PNH program. Because GA, because of what had happened with the counterparty, was considered a loss, right? Mm-hmm. But deep down, we had a really good feeling about that. This was biologically active, that something may come out of this, right? And at the end of July, with weeks of cash in the bank, ready to close on that $60 million deal, I got a call from Federico Grossi, Fede, who many of the audience here know. And he called me from Japan. He says, I just got like the first run on the stats. And he said, like, looks like the shit is working. Those were his literal words. And I had a birthday party in my home. I had 100 people there. And I freaked out, man. I was like, oh my God, what do we do with this? So I basically kicked everybody out, jumped on a plane, went to Boston to meet with Gerald. And we sat down together and Gerald said, look, we can't raise that money at the same valuation because, you know, that's the... So we essentially had to go, went back to that syndicate and said, you can invest 20 million, not 16, right? At the same valuation. But the remaining 40, we're going to see if this is real or not. And if it is real, then we'll renegotiate it, right? The price. Okay. That was fair. And the real readout was going to happen at the end of that month. So... Now it's the middle of August, 15th of August, and I went to our general counsel, Dave Watson, and I said, how long would it take us for us to file to go public? And we did the calendar, and to go public before Thanksgiving, which at the time was a little bit kind of a hallmark in the sense to go public, we had to file our so-called S1 document confidentially at the end of August. We had 2 weeks to do it. Okay. And he looks at me and he's like, that's impossible.
Impossible.
And I said... Says who? So in 2 weeks, we got our S1 filed. It was amazing. Like, so we got it done. And then we had a board meeting in the beginning of September. And at the board meeting, now with, you know, a new director on board as well, I mean, you know, people said, like, look, let's do another private round. Don't go over your skis. Find the file. It's confidential. It's sitting there. Let's just see what happens. So I got instructions to do what's called a private round of investment. And I went to these investors. They're all the same, right? So I asked them, like, if I if hypothetically we were on a roadshow, right? I mean, would that be something that you'd be interested in, right? And they're like, yeah. So then I talked to the bankers. I said, like, how long would it take it for us to do what's called a testing the waters, right? This is where you go and actually officially pitch an IPO to people. And she said, well, it takes a month. And I said, we have 4 days to do it.
Yeah. And Fast roadshow.
In 4 days, we had the money lined up. Everything was where it needed to be. And then it was very interesting at that point in time. There was a whole effort to kind of derail that process. Lots of drama that I won't dive into. But at the end of the day, we got that IPO done in November of 2017. And now we were on a solid track to raise the massive amounts of capital that you need to do what we do. We had two phase three programs that were about to start in geographic atrophy and in PNH. And both, as we know now, were successful and have led to the products Empaveli and Syfovre. So
this is a good point, because I do want to ask you about the phase three data for the Syfovre. This is very important to our listeners. Some of them, many of them already are familiar with it. Our center was in your trial. We recruited a lot of those patients in all of those trials. Well, share, please, with us, the audience, a sketch of the phase three readout, the data, safety, efficacy, whatever you consider important to you and to the company.
Yeah. So the phase three, the Derby and Oaks trials were pretty epic in many, many ways. They were epic in size, right? I mean, 600 patients in each of these two trials. Complete imaging every 2 months, as you know, Firas, thank you. And thank you, whoever's on the call, for participating in those trials. It was an enormous amount of work, enormously expensive for us at the time to embark upon. And in September of 2018, we started dosing the first patients. And I'm going to briefly tell this story as well, because it is another epic moment that defined everything for us, right? So some of you may remember that we dosed a couple of patients, six subjects, and four of the six subjects had inflammation in the eye. And in a randomization of 2-1, that meant everybody had gotten it, right? So I remember going to the board meeting, and we immediately stopped the study, of course. And I went to the board meeting. I said, look, this is terrible, but there are three positive things here. I said, number one, this happened at the beginning of the study. Number two, not in the middle, because then it's over, right? Number two, we've done already close to 1,500 injections in our phase two clinical trial. We never had an issue. Something happened in the manufacturing between the phase two and the phase three that causes this, and we can figure it out. And number three, every patient is getting this. I mean, this is not like a DARPin situation where you have to figure out, 10% of patients get it. What is it? It's impossible, right?
Yeah.
So then, in 4 months and a half, Firas, our team figured out what was going on. And together with some amazing retina docs that helped us figure this out, we did 7 toxicology studies, redid our manufacturing, and it was a piece in the manufacturing that had gone wrong that included kind of an excipient that was causing this. We found it. We took it out of the manufacturing, did a phase 1B. That phase 1B showed it was not completely solved, redid more work, another phase 1B, and then restarted the phase 3 clinical trial in March of 2019, having solved the issue. And it was one day, I will write down that story in detail, because the way in which some of you helped us get through that was absolutely epic and amazing and inspiring to me. So anyway, then the next point, of course, was the readout of the Derby and Oaks trials. And I don't need to remind many of you that the Derby trial read out negatively, right, in September of 2021. And, this is the type of thing I was, I remember vividly getting that phone call from our general counsel. And it's the type of thing that it's like a bad dream, right? I mean, we were very, very convinced, based on the Philly data, that our drug was highly efficacious in this disease. We also were very good with the safety, and we're like, what happened here, right? And at the time, I sat down with the statistician, and he said, "Look, Cedric, we won the inverse lottery." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he's like, "We had very bad patients in our active arm, like rapidly progressive patients, compared to the sham control." And I said, "How do you know that?" And he said, "Well, at 2 months, remember we had every 2 months imaging, at 2 months, the sham was already 20% slower than the active arm." So essentially, the curves were digressing, but in the wrong direction, right?
Yeah.
And then what happened is, as the patient started responding, the curves crossed, right? But at 1 year, they had not had enough time to compensate.
Okay.
And then when we did a curve fit for that, we're like, well, if this drug works, which we think it does, then at 18 months, and certainly at 24 months, this should make up for it, right? So we then decided that we would do two things. One, we would go to the FDA, and we would ask them to take a look at our phase two clinical trial, the Philly trial, right? Because that trial was run with all of the quality of a phase three clinical trial, with lyophilized product instead of a liquid product, the same drug, right? Also double masked. I mean, some people think it was a single mask, but it was double masked at the level of the reading center and at the level of the patients. The physician, you know, knew that it was a real injection or not. So the physician was not masked, but the reading center and the patients were. So we believed that it could qualify as a phase three trial, and the FDA agreed with that. So already within about 2 months after the readout of the Derby and Oaks trials, we got the feedback from the FDA that, you know, we had two positive registrational studies, right? The FDA doesn't make a difference between phase two and phase three. So that was very important for us. So now at least we knew that we were on a solid path, you know, with two positive studies and good safety. But then we said, look, let's go to the FDA and let's propose that instead of filing the 12-month data, we file with the 18-month data. And the FDA agreed with that. We then filed our submission to the FDA, got accelerated review or priority review, I should say, in July of last year. And then in late August, we got the 24-month data from the Derby and Oak studies. And these data were absolutely spectacular, right? So, and the most important feature that we discovered in that data set was that the efficacy of the drug, the way in which the drug slows down GA, amplifies over time, right? So when you look from month 18 to 24, we were getting north of 30% slowdown, right? Highly clinically meaningful and important for patients. And again, with the hope that this would continue to amplify, and we'll see in the end that it does indeed do that, right? Super exciting, because it's like the fire becomes less and less intense, right? And then we said, we should, you know, do we want this in our label? The answer was absolutely yes, we do. But that would mean a 3-month delay on our launch. And at the time, we thought we were going to be shipping the first product in December. Then as the months progressed, we started to realize that to have the product commercially available was going to take longer than we thought it was going to do. And all of a sudden, the advantage of filing an amendment versus not filing an amendment became negligible, other than the perception that, you know, that it's crazy to do a major amendment days or a month before an official approval. So, but we did. And, you know, it couldn't have gone better for us, right? I mean, in the months after that, it was a tough time, because we didn't know whether it would actually lead to what we were hoping for. But so we got the label with, very importantly, the flexibility on dosing, where every other month and monthly were viewed as the same, and it's now on label every 25 to 60 days, providing maximum flexibility in terms of dosing. Also, we had tested this drug in patients with foveal lesions as well as extrafoveal lesions. And at that time point, 18 to 24, the profile becomes very similar for both of these phenotypes. Whereas in the first year, the extrafoveal patients seem to respond better than the foveal patients. And then, you know, again, the increasing effects over time, which manifested itself so beautifully. And then also something that was important in our approval is the fellow eye analysis, right? So not just in the study eye between the active group and the sham, but also in the treated eyes compared to the untreated fellow eye. we saw the efficacy of the drug manifest itself with these increasing effects over time. So it was a great story, led to the approval, of course, and as you can tell, went through many, many iterations before it made it to the finish line.
Well, there's a lot of truth in everything you're saying there. And something that I've discussed with patients actually already is this divergence is an advantage now, because the longer you go, just logically, if you're controlling or slowing a chronic disease, the longer you go, the greater the divergence of those groups are. And you're going to see increasing benefit as the years go on. There's no doubt. And if there may be something there that there's an even synergistic increase in benefit to your point. So the data's good. It's clear. The FDA approved it. I understood that it is a fascinating story, and I followed it pretty closely. And I remember in August when this was going on, and congratulations, you took some gambles and they paid off and it was well thought out. What kind of feedback are you getting thus far from the retina community? Who are the patients that you think, just sort of globally thinking, clinically thinking, that are benefiting from this, who should benefit from this, who would be optimal candidate for this, or what are you hearing? And who are also candidates, but maybe a second tier of candidates, if you can think of it that way?
The uptake has been absolutely extraordinary, right? I mean, and it's a testament to the unmet need that exists out there. I think that what's also really, really important is that now with thousands and thousands of injections done, we start to have a good sense of the real world safety profile, and that also, cross fingers, knock on wood, looks really good right now. We're going to have the GALE data presented soon to show that, extended efficacy and continued improvements on the divergence of the curves. We have the first functional readouts that are becoming available as well, showing that, as you would expect, that function follows the functional lesion reduction as well. And I think that the real world experience, at least from what I've heard from physicians, has been very good as well, right? So it's a product that is not exactly like an anti-VEGF. The volume is a little bit larger. It's a little bit more viscous, right? So, but from what I hear, I don't know what your experience has been. You get used to it, and then it's like a very regular procedure to do. I think in terms of the patients that are being first adopted, I think a lot of retina docs kind of start with patients with bilateral GA. And I think a lot of retina docs are starting with the worst seeing eye, just to kind of get the handle on, is this product safe? How does it work in my hands, et cetera? So I expect that to evolve, as it should, right? Towards the better seeing eye, being the one that benefits the most, and both eyes being treated. We also have patients with macular atrophy secondary to anti-VEGF treatments that are very interesting, with physicians looking into kind of alternating regimens of a month anti-VEGF, a month Syfovre, and going back and forth between those. But I think ultimately, and this is really for me the holy grail, right? When you look at the OCT findings that we have, not just the autofluorescence, and you segment the retinal, the photoreceptors from the RPE cell layer, what we've come to realize is that the protection on the photoreceptor cells is near complete with Syfovre. With the RPE cells, which is what we measure with autofluorescence, it slows it down with the increasing effects over time, right? But it takes time and it's not complete, right? So, and what we see is that in patients where in the beginning, where the photoreceptor cells die first, and if you think about it, like the soil and the grass, right? I mean, there's a whole area, which is our typical geographic atrophy, where there's no soil, no grass, but then there's a whole area with RPE cells, the soil, but no grass, no photoreceptor cells supporting them anymore, right? And then outside of that, intact photoreceptor cells. So what we see is in these patients, the photoreceptor cells stop dying immediately. 100%. And, that's something that we saw in Philly, in Derby and Oaks, and that we see in Gale now as well. But then when the soil catches up with the photoreceptor cells, then they die in conjunction because the photoreceptor cells are no longer supported. So it's just fascinating science that we're continuing to understand better and better as we progress. But it also means that you really want to treat these patients as early as possible when the RPE deficit is as small as possible. And I think, you know, my hope is that the data continues to mature, that the safety continues to mature the way it does, and that we start treating these patients earlier and earlier, because that's where they will benefit the most.
Yeah, I agree. And for the record, I am using it, and I find the procedure to be as expected. Yes, a little greater volume. You know, counsel the patient about a little darkening of vision immediately after. This is a little different, but essentially the same procedure we've all, you know, become super handy with. And I am treating the better eye. That's actually been my preference. So if I'm choosing one, I've so far in my small anecdotal series have almost universally chosen the better eye. I kind of feel like, and the patients have agreed, more bang for their buck for the commitment of time and energy and the procedure. But we'll, you know, a lot's going to come out here in the next 6 to 12 months, and certainly in the next 24. I agree with you. The data in real life now will mature, to use your term correctly. It's going to mature incredibly, and you're going to get wonderful volumes of feedback now on where this drug really helps and really works. And the retina community, I found it's a pretty industrious community and a pretty entrepreneurial and pretty scientific, as you've come to know. I think the hand surgeons apparently are the same. I don't know too many. I know they're pretty industrious and entrepreneurial as well. But seriously, the retina doctors like science, they follow the science, but they also don't mind creating a little bit of their own clinical science sort of anecdotally and running with it and publishing it or not publishing it. And you're going to get a lot of this feedback, and I think it's going to help you think about future uses and future directions for your drug. And I like this information about the photoreceptors. I did not know this, and that's a really fascinating potential for this drug. I'm excited to know this. With the few minutes we have remaining, since we're on the subject of, you know, how do we move forward now, a couple of things come to mind for me for questions for you about future directions. And I know you've thought about this. Of course you have. And you can only share what you feel comfortable sharing. But specifically with regard to drug delivery technology or improved specific diagnostics to help both the durability of the drug in the former and the proper utilization and administration of the drug in the latter. Any thoughts on this and any directions you're looking at there?
Yes. On the diagnostic front, I'm particularly excited about AI. And I truly believe that in the not too distant future, that you would be able to predict in your patients, if you do not do anything, this is the path that your retina will follow, right? If you are on treatments and you're compliant, you know, this is the benefit that you may gain from it. And you'll be able to track that benefit. One of the things I'm very excited about is if we use this AI tool properly, right, then automated readings will become the standards. And you can tell a patient in the first 6 months of treatment, this is how much RPE cells you lost. This is how much photoreceptor cells you lost. That does not mean anything compared to control groups, right? But the next 6 months with these increasing effects, you can say now it's less and less and less, right? That in terms of compliance and knowing what you are getting for that investment that you're making with your time and effort, I think is going to be really important and exciting. And it will also allow us to predict who the better responders are going to be, which patients will benefit the most. So diagnostically, I'm very excited about that. And I think that will find its way either on a cloud-based platform or incorporated into the classical OCT instruments in the very near future. On the treatment front, there are kind of two main objectives. One is to, of course, to reduce the treatment burden. I mean, if we could do an injection every 3 months, that's better than every two. We all know that, right? And we are committed to doing that. We have various ways of approaching that particular problem. The second one is, you know, to put it simplistically, going back to the story earlier, how do we give RPE cells the same perfect protection that we seem to be giving to photoreceptor cells, right? If we can do that, then there may be a way of stopping this disease in its tracks. very early on in the course of treatment. That has incredible appeal to me, to us as a company, and that's something that we're going to be pursuing vigorously.
This is amazing. Fascinating story, Cedric, my friend Cedric, Dr. Cedric Francois. I'm so pleased that you came on, but also to share the long history and now the recent exciting developments for you and your company. I want to personally congratulate you, and the retina community is excited. We all are congratulating you, and we'll have you back on sometime in the future. You can give us feedback on what's turned out in the next year or two. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Firas. It was a real joy. Thank you.
Thank you.